preach, I ask three questions as part of my preparation. The first question, and these aren't in a particular order other than the order that I do them. The first question is, what is the text saying? The text can say more than one thing, but I have to say what it is saying. I can't just read a text and then say what I want to say. What is the text saying? The second question is, what is God saying to these people through what the text is saying? That's where I spend a lot of time praying and often wrestling with God. What is it that you are saying through this text? And then the third one is, what is the best way to say it? So I have a confession this morning, and that confession is my prayer this week. I realized just this morning has really been on the second question, God, what are you saying to me through this text? So in many ways, I am preaching the sermon that I desperately need to hear, and if you are at all like me, I suspect you need to hear it as well. This morning, we are in our 30th sermon in the book of Exodus. As you know, Exodus is the story of a group of people from the early Iron Age. Think about that for a moment. Iron Age people, early Iron Age people. We're reading the story of a people from a world that was just discovering that weapons made out of iron were, and tools made out of iron were superior to weapons and tools made out of bronze. That's advanced technology. Our military today has weapons that literally they have 20-year-olds sitting in a room with an Xbox controller flying these drones all over the world. Literally, they actually use a modified Xbox controller because that's what 20-year-olds know how to use. Advanced, I mean, think of the world of the Exodus. Advanced technology was iron, not steel. It was iron, which means you had to make sure that you kept your weapons in good condition because they would rust immediately when exposed to water. Well, if your week was anything like mine, you may be wondering what a text about a group of Iron Age people camping around a mountain in a wilderness has to do with you and me and with our very modern, very technologically advanced problems. Think of our problems today, right? We have drama on social media, whether that's InstaChat or TwitFace or Snapbook. We have pressure that comes from working in high-pressure environments, right? We have to deal with check engine lights and medical bills and corporate politics and elected officials tweeting. What kind of problems could a group of people who literally camped for a living have that even compares to the problems we face? Well, Israel's problems weren't technological. Israel's biggest problems were Israel. I'm sure you can see the connection. What kind of problems did a group of Iron Age people have that you and I have? The same kind of problems. The technology surrounding those problems may have been different, but the problems are the same. And the good news for Israel, and therefore for us today, is found in Exodus 23. So if you would turn there with me. Exodus 23, we're going to begin reading this morning in verse 20. This is God speaking to Moses. It says in verse 20, "Behold, I send an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you to the place that I have prepared. Pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Do not rebel against him, for he will not pardon your transgression, for my name is in him. But if you carefully obey his voice and do all that I say, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. When my angel goes before you and brings you to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will blot them out, you shall not bow down to their gods nor serve them, nor do as they do, but you shall utterly overthrow them and break their pillars in pieces. You shall serve Yahweh your God, and he will bless your bread and your water, and I will take sickness away from among you. None shall miscarry or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my terror before you, and will throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come, and I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, the Hittites from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the wild beasts multiply against you. Little by little I will drive them out from before you, until you have increased and possessed the land. And I will set your border from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines and from the wilderness to the Euphrates. For I will give the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them and with their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. Our text this morning contains the closing words of the book of the law. Right? So remember where we are in the story of the Exodus. God rescued Israel out of Egypt, out of the land, or out of the house of slavery. He brought them to himself at the foot of Mount Sinai, where they assembled all together before him to receive the covenant. God began to speak with them his promises. Those promises, the covenant began with the Ten Commandments. But before he could continue, Israel was afraid. Remember, they pleaded with Moses that they didn't want to hear God's voice anymore. The truth is, God is holy, and so his presence is frightening. They pleaded with Moses, you go up the mountain, you listen to God, and then you come back down here and you tell us what he has to say. We don't want to hear his voice anymore. So keep in mind that everything that happens after that was said after the Ten Commandments, including up and through our text, is what God would have said next to Israel if they had been willing to hear his voice. They weren't, so the rest of this is said directly to Moses, and then later will be communicated to them from Moses, or by Moses. So God promises to send an angel before them on their way into the land he promised them. Now, there's some debate as to who this angel is. What is the identity of this angel? Some think it's Moses. Some think it might be Joshua. Some think it's just a regular old angel. Look at what God says about this particular angel. In verse 21, he tells them to pay careful attention to the angel and obey the angel's voice. That should sound familiar. Remember our text from last week. Look back at verse 13. What does he say? Pay attention to all that I have said to you. Verse 21, pay careful attention to him and obey his voice. Truth is, I think we've seen this angel before. Back in chapter 3, when Moses is in the wilderness and God speaks to him from the burning bush, the text says it was the angel of Yahweh who was speaking to him from the burning bush. And even earlier, back in the book of Genesis, which was written by Moses, remember the story of Hagar? Abraham sends her away because Sarah was ticked that she had a baby and Sarah hadn't had one yet. So she's out in the middle of the wilderness and God appears to her. The angel of Yahweh appeared to her. Genesis 16 says the angel of Yahweh found her by a spring of water in the wilderness. But later in that chapter, Hagar says this about this angel. So she called the name of Yahweh who spoke to her. You are a God of seeing, for she said, truly, here I have seen him who looks after me. So who is the angel of Yahweh? Well, notice what else God says about this angel. He says the angel, remember, angel just means messenger. The angel will go with Israel to lead them into the promised land. They must be sure to obey the voice of this angel, and they must not rebel against him. And why not? Because the angel, this messenger from God, will not pardon your transgression. Now, I don't happen to think that God is being Captain Obvious here. I mean, what the people said about Jesus and forgiving sins in Mark chapter 2, not the blasphemy part, but the rest of it was actually true. They said this, why does this man speak like that? He is blaspheming. They asked this question, who can forgive sins but God alone? No one can forgive sins but God alone. And yet Jesus forgave sins, but as we know, Jesus is God in human form. I mean, if this were an ordinary angel, or if this were Moses, or if this were Joshua, then God's declaration that the angel wouldn't pardon their transgressions is kind of obvious. Well, duh. You're like someone warning you, don't mess with JT, or JT won't forgive your sins. Whether you mess with JT or not, you don't have to worry about JT forgiving your sins. JT can't forgive your sins. This angel, however, this messenger from God, appears to have the ability to forgive sins. I think this is because the angel is Yahweh himself. Do you see the promise that God makes? God promises Israel that Yahweh will be with them as they head to the land God has prepared for them. Now, he doesn't promise to merely be with them. interesting observation. I noticed something while sitting in the car with I think it was Trey, still in the car seat while Donnie was inside getting, you know, a few thousand things. Is that out loud? But I noticed that when families with young children walk into the store, they tend to do it very differently. This isn't 100% of time. It's not that every time a woman walks her kids in, she does it this way, every time a man did. But there is a very real pattern that emerged as I watched this. And all these years since, I continue to watch for this because I find it fascinating. And that's this. When a woman leads her young children into the grocery store through a parking lot, she generally walks behind them with her arms out kind of like this, guiding them, keeping them together. Right? But when a man leads his kids into the grocery store, he's like this, come on, I'm going this way. Not every time, but generally speaking, the man is actually, and I don't think it's a conscious decision. I don't think a man is intentionally doing this, but I think there's an instinctual sense of responsibility. I have to go before my family because if a car is going to come speeding by, I'm going to be able to stop them. Or I'm the one who's going to get hit and not the little ones. Again, it's not 100% of the time. But it is a distinct pattern. God says in the text, he will go before Israel to root out any danger that is waiting for them. God will lead them into the land, going before them to make a safe path for them. Now to be sure, Scripture also uses very feminine images of God. For example, Jesus wept over the city of Jerusalem, saying that he longed to gather them together under his wings, as a hen, that's the female chicken, as a hen gathers her chicks. It's a very feminine image. The time will come that Israel will need to be nurtured, and when they do, God will certainly nurture them as a mother nurtures her child. But that's not what Israel needs as they enter the promised land. Israel doesn't need a mama in this moment. Israel needs a warrior to enter the land before them and to root out all the danger. God promises to do exactly that. See, the truth is God will be what we need him to be. To those who humble themselves before him, he is a merciful Savior. But to those who remain in their stubborn rebellion, he is a holy and righteous judge. To those who are hurting and need comfort, he is the great comforter. To those in danger, he is the great warrior who will destroy their enemies. This is kind of what he was getting at when he told Moses, I am who I am. But part of what that means is, I will be who you need me to be. I'm far bigger than any single metaphor or illustration could ever capture. Well, it's interesting that our text begins with this declaration of God's power and protection. You see, even when God says, if you do this, then I will do that, it is always in light of what he has already done. For example, do you remember how this whole section in Exodus started all the way back in chapter 19 when they first get to Mount Sinai? Remember, turn back to Exodus 19, verse 4. God says to Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples. You see that formula there, right? If you will do this, then I will do that. If you will obey me, then you will be my treasured possession. So it all depends on Israel. In order for Israel to be God's treasured possession among the nations, Israel has to do something. Israel has to bring this about, right? Nope. Look what he says right before. You yourselves have seen how I judged Egypt for you. You yourselves have seen how I brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, how I bore you on eagle's wings. I've already done that. You have seen how I brought you to myself. Now, if you will do this, then I will do this other thing. But it's because God has already rescued them. When God gives them an if-then formula, he's simply telling them, this is what the right response to what I've already done looks like. I have already rescued you from Egypt. Now then do this so that I am able to do this other thing in response to your obedience. He's already done the real work. This is why Israel must pay careful attention to Yahweh and they must obey his voice. They must not rebel against him or he will not pardon their transgression. A transgression is a violation of a known rule. He has the covenant filled with rules. This is how you ought to live. He will be with them. He promises to be an enemy to their enemies and to be an adversary to their adversaries. And he will deal with any obstacles they face. peoples who already live there is an act of judgment against them. But this judgment comes after an incredible amount of time of patience on the part of God. Remember back in Genesis 15 when God was making all these promises to God? He promised he would do this. Listen to this from Genesis 15. Then Yahweh said to Abraham, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. That's the land of Egypt, the house of slavery. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for you, Abraham, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here." Abraham's in Canaan at that time. "They shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." Well, there the Amorites is simply shorthand for all of those tribes living in the land of Canaan. We notice what God said to Abraham. Their iniquity, their rebellion against me isn't yet complete. It hasn't reached that boiling point, the point of no return, after which I will not offer mercy. Their sins weren't yet so bad that he was ready to remove them, but they will be in another 400 years. Verse 23, God tells Israel his angel will go before them into the land of Canaan. And then the Amorites and Hittites and Perizzites and Canaanites and Hivites and Jebusites will be blotted out. Their iniquity will finally be complete. It will have reached that point of no return. God will bring righteous judgment on one group by removing them from the land so that he could give it to another group. But notice the reason for the extent of this judgment against the Canaanites in verse 24. God tells Israel that they must not bow down to the gods of Canaan, nor shall they serve the gods of Canaan, nor shall they do as the Canaanites do. Instead, Israel must utterly overthrow them and destroy their idols and their places of worship. Now we have to recognize how easy it would have been for the Israelites to worship the gods of the Canaanites. See, the temptation would actually be very strong, which may sound strange. Like, hold on, they just saw this God do an incredible work and bring them out. There's all these miracles in the wilderness, parting of the Red Sea and the manna, and then the quail come and water is turned and made into fresh, sweet water. The temptation would have been very strong to do as the Canaanites do. You see, in the ancient Near East, you actually had to work for food. Sounds strange, you have a lot of jobs, but you actually had to work for food. Everything was done by hand. I mean, sure, your team of oxen would pull a plow, but it's not as though the man pulling the plow was sitting in an air-conditioned tractor cabin, right, sipping on sweet tea while listening to top 40 hits from the 80s on Sirius XM. He was manually driving that plow through the earth. Sure, the oxen pulled it, but that was very physically strenuous labor. It was not easy. And then he had to stop because there'd be a rock, and he had to dig the rock out, he had to move that. I mean, this was a lot of work. But even after you plowed and planted, it's not like you can just go over and turn on the sprinkler and grab the hose to water your crops. In the ancient Near East, the people worshipped various gods because that was how you got your crops to grow. That's just what you did. Everybody knows this. I mean, come on. You plan it, but yeah, sure, you got to do your part, which is worship these gods. I mean, sure, you do hook up your oxen and your plow and you plant the seed, but you also have to worship the gods responsible for making the crops grow. That's just how it was done. The temptation for Israel to do it this way would have been powerful. God knows they would be tempted to plant the way the Canaanites planted. God knows they'd be tempted to harvest the way the Canaanites harvest, which means God knows they would be tempted to worship the way the Canaanites worshipped. They need to survive, so they would be tempted to do what everyone else did in order to survive. You know, we saw a similar thing in the book of Revelation, right? Believers in those seven cities where those seven churches were often forced to choose between faithfulness to Jesus and offering just a pinch of incense out on an altar, the words, "Caesar is Lord." I mean, what's the big deal? It's not like they were denying Jesus is also Lord, right? Except the entire book of Revelation was written to warn them to not offer a pinch of incense to Caesar when the soldiers grabbed him. They must not compromise in this way. And so Israel must not compromise with the people of the land. The fact is, God will not share his glory with another. I mean, the idols that the Canaanites worshipped, they were just blocks of wood and stone. That's all they were. They cannot hear. They cannot see. They cannot make it rain. They cannot provide. They can't make the crops grow. Only the God of Israel can hear and see and respond to them. Only the God of Israel is alive and able to hear and do. Only the God of Israel can make the crops grow. And this God will not share his glory with a block of wood. Because of this, God warns them to destroy the idols they will come across in the new land and to tear down the pillars. Now, the pillars refer to a physical structure where these gods were worshipped. Israel must destroy them. Simply removing them from sight wasn't enough. They must be destroyed, because if they remained, they would pose a very real danger to Israel. But then notice the promise he makes in light of this. He says that they shall serve Yahweh, and he will bless them with bread and water, and I will take away their sickness, and they themselves will be fertile and miscarry. And not miscarry. Do you catch the change of pronouns in verse 25? He, the angel, Yahweh, will bless them, and I, also Yahweh, will take away their sickness. The truth is, they don't need the gods of Canaan, because Yahweh is their God, and he can actually bless them and provide for them. In fact, he already has. All I got to do is look at his track record over the last 3 months. He then promises to give them the land, which requires the removal of the people already there. And he lists some ways that he's going to do this. And these are just fascinating to me. First, he says he will send his terror before them. I don't know what this terror is, but whatever it is, it scares the people already there. In fact, you read the book of Joshua after Jericho's destroyed, the people in Jericho, they were already afraid, right? We see the terror when Rahab speaks to the spies coming in. So he'll send his terror before them. And presumably, that's what results in their enemies being thrown into confusion in battle. I mean, the commanding officer says, go that way. Like, that's where the enemies are. I'm confused. What do you want me to do here? Since he will make their enemies turn and flee. And then he says, look, all I really need to do is send some hornets to drive the people out of the land. Some bugs. Right? I mean, when God goes to war, all he needs are a few bees. Think about that. Can you imagine, you know, the U.S. military, here's our, 10th Mountain Bee Division. What are you going to do with those? We're going to go get the bad guys when they attack us. They're sting them, and they're going to run and battle. When God goes to war, he only needs some bugs. Notice how he'll do this. He says, little by little. In his kindness, he will not drive out the people all at once. The fact is, at this point in history, Israel is still, there's a lot of them, but they're still too few in number to fill the land. Right? All those centuries before, as the people of the land had cleared trees and made cropland and, grazing land, if they suddenly were gone from all of the land in the next 100, 200, 300 years, by the time Israel has grown enough to fill the land, all those fields would be overgrown with trees again, and they'd have to go and do all that hard physical labor of removing the trees. All the animals, the bears and the lions and such, that had been driven out by the presence of humans from those places, would have returned. Instead, God will remove the people from the land as Israel grows. This will take some time, but as they are able to handle the growth, God will give them more and more, but he will do so little by little. In his time frame, not theirs. Because he will drive them out little by little, he warns them they must be aware of the real danger. Look again at verse 32. He ends this section. You shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. You'll drive them out little by little, which means they're going to remain for quite a while. Do not make a covenant with them. Do not make a covenant with their gods. As Israel expands, they must not allow the people to dwell in the land that is in their midst. As their border grows and expands, they got to be pushed out. Unless they worship the God you worship, they got to be driven out. If they're allowed to remain, then they will make Israel sin against God. If Israel serves the Canaanite gods, their worship of these gods will actually be another form of slavery to them. Well, maybe you've had a week like mine. I hope not. I hope not. It was a long as I've thought over these last 7 years, who have walked away from the full cost of following Jesus, those who have determined in their very flawed math that the cost of following Jesus wasn't worth it. But remember those who've lost through death or moving out of state or just going to another church. I've been reminded of the mistakes I've made as an inexperienced pastor, of my desperate need for God's sanctifying work in my life. See, milestones, like a 7th anniversary for a church, are great for reflection. But they can lead to second-guessing and regret. But milestones can also lead to hope. And I've been filled this past week with a renewed sense of hope. See, all that I've mentioned so far is last Sunday. That was last Sunday. I haven't gotten to the rest of the week. Those are the highs and lows of last Sunday. The rest of my week included the news that my father-in-law likely has cancer. I've been discouraged and disappointed at several other things that I cannot mention publicly. I spent all day Thursday at a conference with my wife. It was great. It's a conference on race and justice. Walked away with an overwhelming sense of the enormity of the problem we have right here in our city, let alone the rest of our nation. I was challenged by the need for justice, but I was left hopeful for the very real possibility of justice. Joel was there. On Friday, I was able to spend several hours with friends in a hospital, and while I enjoy my friends very much, I'm still in the hospital. Right? The weight of that hangs heavy while waiting for surgery to be over to get the good word from the doctor. And yesterday morning, I came into the office to discover the building was ice cold because the boiler inexplicably shut down. Sixth. I know, that's a first world problem. But I live in the first world. The emotional ups and downs of a week like this leave me feeling rather exhausted. Which is exactly why a text like Exodus 23, a text written about and to a group of Iron Age men and women, is so encouraging this morning. What does our text have to do with my week? Everything. It has everything to do with what I'm facing. See, what God was announcing to the Israelites in this text is that the battle is already over. The victory is already sure. I still have to go through the battle. I still have to be involved. But the outcome is never in doubt. That's the message I need this week. Like Israel, the battle was never mine in the first place, even as I try to make it mine. I have to engage in the battle, but I'm not responsible for the outcome of the battle. See, this last week I had one responsibility. Obedience. I don't know what this coming week's going to bring. Hopefully it'll be a little easier for me. I like to be able to sleep at night. But this coming week I have one responsibility. Obedience. See, God has already won the battle because God has already gone before me into next week, right? And he can lead me anywhere he wants to lead me because I can trust him. And he is bigger and stronger than any obstacle I could possibly face. So at the very least, this means I mustn't serve other gods. And I don't mean bowing down to a block of wood or stone. I mean chasing after the things that I think will make me feel better, the things I think will give me hope and peace in this world. The promise from God is that he will accomplish his purposes. Whether that means he has to send his terror before me against those who would seek to stop his work, or he has to throw them into confusion when they attack, or all he has to do is send some bugs. If that's all he has to do, and it is all he has to do, I can trust him. The battle is over. It has been decided, even if I still have to fight. So the hope that you and I are given through this text is that God will be what you and I need him to be. If you need God's comfort this week, the good news is he will be that mother hen who gathers his chicks under his wing. That's God, right? He will shelter you from the storm. But if you need a powerful warrior to rise up and face your enemies for you, he will be that. He has already won the victory. He will grab his sword and his shield, and he will walk straight into that battle ahead of us. And know that God is undefeated in battle. So you can rise up and follow him anywhere. We have to understand that God is fighting the battle on his terms, within his parameters, within his time frame. sometimes the promise is that he will do this great work little by little. Our responsibility is simply to obey, to go where he leads, and do what he commands. The temptation for us, for you, for me, is to face our problems and difficulties the way people around us do so. The temptation for us is to value the battle tactics that the world values. The temptation is to think that we must fight the battle. To think that it's all up to us whether we win or lose. See, it doesn't matter what you face during the week. Be a classroom of students who are as unruly as I was. And I can't imagine having heart condition and teaching a shop class. I know when I was in metal shop, we had those little clickers for lighting our torches, but we just loved turning the gas on and then walking up to the guy already welding. Because that big poof was really funny. Yeah, I was that kid. Where you have to go to an office where your boss is oppressive, hard to deal with. Not you, don't I? Where you face financial pressures and creditors calling you for your last dollar. Or you have health problems. Or you have pain in your relationships. The battle is not ours to fight. The battle belongs to the Lord. He has promised to go before us and deal with the enemy for us. We are simply called to obey. The temptation is to think that we are alone, that we are unarmed, that we are unprepared in the battle. To fight a battle we cannot win. You and I are just like a group of Iron Age men and women camping in a wilderness. There are too many in the land we're trying to take. There are too many obstacles to the successful conquering of the land. The enemies of God are too powerful. Like those men and women, the battle isn't ours. The battle belongs to God. We only have to follow where he takes us. Remember, God promised that his name would be in the angel, right? I will put my name in him, or my name is in him. We follow Jesus, whose very name means Yahweh saves. We know this because God raised him from the dead. We know he has secured it. Think of this. We know God has secured the victory for us because on the third day, he raised Jesus from the grave. We are resurrection people. Our hope in the battle lies in the resurrection of Jesus, because the absolute worst thing that could happen to Jesus was that they take his life. And we know how that turned out. God raised Jesus from the dead, and that really guarantees the victory for us, which means we can be faithful and follow him wherever.